Good evening, everybody. My name is Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How you all doing? First of all, I want to thank the committee for inviting us down here, and I wish you the best on your endeavors getting this off to what I'm sure will be soon a tradition to come back to this convention. It's really a delight to be here. Whenever I talk in AA, I always have a little trick I do for myself to not get nervous, and that is I just imagine I'm talking to somebody in their first week. And so I assume that somewhere in this room there's somebody in your first week of AA, and that makes me very comfortable because I've been in almost 21 years, and I figure that there's no way I don't know a little bit more about Alcoholics Anonymous than you do. And from that perspective, I get very comfortable, you know, that at least somewhere in this room, there's someone who might be able to learn something from what I say tonight, and if not, it's going to do me a lot of good. I've always been amazed at how Alcoholics Anonymous works. In the outside world, the further up the ladder you've gone, the more often you're asked to speak. In AA, they go, let's see, we got all these people, 300-400 people that come in here, they're going to hang on every word of somebody who's spent 6 months in a nut ward, who just sort of went downhill all through his career. You know, in other words, started out in college and then went to jail. You know what I mean? And go, let's take notes from this guy because he's obviously got it together, you know. And sometimes I'm reluctant to share certain things, but they've been shared a little bit already, so I will go into that. I sometimes like to say that lots of things happen to alcoholics. And I look back on some of the things that have happened to me. I got thrown out of the Marine Corps. That's real hard to do. Been through about 12 jobs, through bankruptcy, saw 3 marriages fall apart. And all of this is after I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. So I know all that, and I keep getting invited to these things. And the reason I come is to find out why. You know, I really want to listen to that guy and follow right along. So I'm as amazed as you are. But I enjoy it immensely, and you know, what we find out is something that I learned from Chuck C. And as Pat was talking, the idea of being somebody. That's a wonderful topic. It's a wonderful thing to think about because I think that feeling is part of the human dilemma, is that we're sort of born with that inside of us, and maybe we don't recognize it right away, but as we start growing along in this journey on life, or this journey through life, there's this little feeling inside there that says, you know, I'm just not anybody yet. You know what I mean? And so you look around at other people who are somebody, and you see them, the football captain or somebody who's get all A's in school or whatever it is, and you look over and you go, now there's somebody, and here's me. You know what I mean? And then you go, it's too bad that I'm still nobody. And you try to figure out how you go from being nobody to somebody, because if you could just get there, you'd have this whole dilemma figured out. And along the way, you get various instruction. You hang around some people, you know, and they give you some ideas. Well, I'll tell you, when we'll get somebody. And I learned a lot of real valuable information on the walls of toilets. People shared their philosophy about certain secrets of life. And I'd read in there, you know, and go, damn, I didn't know that. That's real interesting. Well, no wonder I've been a little off course here. I'll just factor that in. I was a little embarrassed to ask anybody, so I just sort of kept it to myself, but it was nice to know those things. And went on through and drew certain conclusions about how a person would become somebody. And I followed, you know, I ended up with a lot of the same conclusions that most of us end up with, and that is, it involves money, that's obviously part of it, and power and prestige, and once you accumulate all that, they will work synergistically on you and produce the feeling of being somebody. And so I set about my little target of aiming at certain things. I had an uncle who was a pilot in World War II, Air Force pilot, and I remember just looking at him just going, there's a captain in the Air Force pilot. And I just knew, I mean, I knew this, that as much as I knew that the sun came up in the morning, that if you were ever a captain that was a pilot, you would automatically be somebody. And the funny thing is, as I chugged along, and so many of us I've heard in talks around the country, as we got there, whatever this ladder was, where you finally became somebody, it didn't work. You know what I mean? When I graduated from high school, it wasn't a big deal. You know what I mean? I just had to get there. If anything that I could do wasn't much. And as soon as I accomplished it, it was diminished by the fact that I did it. You know what I'm talking about? And so all of these things that were going to make me somebody didn't work. The bottom fell out as soon as I got there. And I remember when I got in the Marine Corps and got to be a pilot, and then I was a first lieutenant. First I thought just being a pilot would make you somebody. And I'm looking in the mirror, and I'm going, see those wings? Now you're somebody. And there was that little voice inside that went, nobody. And I went, thanks a lot. It was like that Parquet margarine ad, you know what I mean? It just, butter, you know, it just went margarine or parquet, whatever it was. And that was plaguing me. Plaguing me was the voice inside that kept saying, in spite of all the evidence out there, nobody. You know what I'm talking about? That little voice that gets you about 3 o'clock in the morning, you're sitting on the bed, and all of a sudden that feeling comes over, and you just go, you're going nowhere, you're nobody, and you're a loser, and you're nothing. And all this information to the contrary, you may have accumulated some possessions, you have a family, you're doing this, you're doing that, but there's something inside. And so, you know, I look at sobriety and I look at the disease of alcoholism in the context of fixing that human situation of trying to be somebody, whatever that may mean. And I remember when I got promoted to captain, boy, was I excited. I knew this was going to be it. And putting those bars on and going home and looking in the mirror and that same thing happened, you know, it was just nobody. It just wasn't there. But on the other hand, there was something that had come into my life that seemed to work on a rather regular basis. And this stuff was alcohol. Now, alcohol, for me, I'm one of these primary alcoholics that they write about. Marty Mann wrote about that, and they still write about him, I guess, in these textbooks. And I guess we're the alcoholics who drink socially 10, 11 minutes, somewhere roughly, and cross over the invisible line, or we're born on the other side of the invisible line, and we don't understand at all when you speakers get up here who talk about drinking for 20 years with no trouble, and then the filter broke, and all hell broke loose, and I just go, what are you talking about? You drank for 20 years with no trouble. Just the first drink went down, but as a primary alcoholic, when I say that, the effect of alcohol was so significant and spontaneous at age 19 in a university where I felt that same feeling of being nobody. And here these guys came from all over the United States into New Haven. That was my hometown, and that's where I grew up, and so to me it wasn't any big deal to go to the local school, but people came from all over and thought this was really something. And I just remember watching people at social events and wondering how they got so much poise and how they intuitively knew how to handle situations, and you know what I'm talking about, and all that social graces and everything, and I just walked around the fringes of the academic society waiting for somebody to invite me in to tell me where my place was. Where's the manual on fitting into life? I feel like so many AA members that when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew everything about the world except I hadn't taken Life 101 yet. And that was the only thing was missing. I did not know what life was all about nor how to live, but I had everything else down pat. You know, I had a car, a driver's license, home, clothes, credit card. I just had this one little fine-tuning to do, which was, how do you live, and why? What is life all about, and why doesn't anything make sense, and why am I thinking of suicide most of the time if life is so wonderful and I've got it all figured out? So I had the dilemma, I guess, of trying to become a grown-up. You know what I mean? You know, I know what they look like. I feel like I'm getting closer now. And when my father asked me, and he asked me just last year, what am I going to be when I grow up? And at least I have an answer now of what I do want to be, and believe it or not, it's a grown-up. I've decided that that's one of the great gifts that a human being can give to themselves, is to become a grown-up in the sense that I've learned about it here in AA. But getting back to that feeling of not being anybody and wanting to figure it out. I mean, that was a very frustrating thing. And it was under those conditions that I started drinking. And I remember taking that first drink. And I always like to talk about that, that here I am with 25, 50 people and feeling ill at ease and sensing that they don't want me there. Saw a lot of hostility in their eyes. They had already divided up in little groups and were talking with themselves. And they did this deliberately to ignore me. And walked around, you know, over to this side of the room, hello, sort of looking in, and they look back, get the hell out of here, you son of a gun. Went over here, got the same rude treatment, and, you know, I just went, where's the instruction book? And the tray of drinks came around, and I was holding out on starting drinking. I had come to grips with the Catholic Church many years earlier, and had run into some serious problems there with purgatory. And I've never been back, so I don't remember all of the details, but I do remember that every single thing I did, for some unknown reason, translated into years and decades in a place called purgatory, and there was a some kind of a special reprieve that would get you out of there light years early if you didn't drink until you were 21. And so I was hooked into that thing, but this awkwardness in this room that night seemed more of a problem than purgatory. So I said, to hell with it. Maybe there's no such place. You know what I mean? And besides, you know, when the rest of your crowd starts drinking, if you don't, that's real unusual. And you have to answer for it all. Well, why aren't you drinking? Well, purgatory, this and that. And so that wasn't working. So, you know, and besides, I was very curious. People were telling me of the great benefits of drinking and how, God, it makes you feel good. It's wonderful. I can't believe you go through Saturday night just feeling the way you are. And just get with it, get with it. So in the interest of feeling better, whatever was going to happen, that's when I started my drinking, and I probably had two or three glasses of whiskey or whatever was on the tray and stood there waiting for this magic whatever was going to happen. And I remember being greatly disappointed that nothing was happening. I just stood there and I went, God, this stuff is broken. Nothing is happening. And I stood there waiting. And as I was waiting to see what was going to happen inside of me, a very unusual thing happened. They took the 50 people, the rude people, who had previously been in the room, and replaced them with the nicest bunch of people I can't tell you the smiles that were on their face. Everybody was looking at me going, please come over to our group and tell us jokes and entertain us. And I said, oh, wait in line. I'll start over here. I'll go over here and then I'll go over there. Just have a drink or something like that. I'll get there as soon as I can. And I went around and just shared myself. And I said, now this is more like it. This is the way the world ought to be. This is the way human beings ought to treat each other. There was this love and there was a sense of being at peace with myself. And I was somebody. I knew it. I could feel it. And I was part of something. And the harmony and all the things I had heard about but had never experienced were going on. And I'd only been drinking for 15 minutes, you know. And drinking went from an unknown in my life to the single most important thing that I had ever come across. And I knew from that night on that whatever life had in store for me, drinking was going to be part of it. Because it just made everything work better. It gave me the key to understanding. It was as if I was a flashlight and somebody finally gave me some batteries. You know, and the light went on, and I said, this is how it works. You know, the thing that's been missing is that whatever that stuff is that turns the system on. My computer was unplugged. There was something was missing, and alcohol was the answer. The other friends of mine who may have started drinking that same year didn't have that happen to them. They had, the non-alcoholics, even guys who like to drink a lot, drinking gave them an opportunity to have a better time. It made for a happier Saturday night. But it was not the answer to life for them. And for me, it was just amazing what that was. In a very literal sense, alcohol was a higher power. In every definition of a higher power, that's what that stuff was. It was something that I could have faith in. It was something that took care of all problems. You know, we talk in Alcoholics Anonymous about you work the solution. We have a solution here. We have a program of 12 steps, and you just work those steps and concentrate on the solution, and the problems take care of themselves. It doesn't matter what the problems are. We go back to the same answer. And, that same thing was true with alcohol. It didn't really matter what the problem was. What's the problem? Tired? Have a drink. What's the problem? You can't go to sleep? Have a drink. What's the problem? You're angry? Have a drink. Calm down. What's the problem? Depressed? Have a drink. Pep up. You know, whatever the problem was, we had this one answer. And it was a very simple way of life. It just, for me, there was drinking. And that was just, so quick. Within a matter of months, I had developed a lifestyle that just centered on alcohol. And that's where it stayed until I got into AA. I drank for 15 years, which really I realize now is not very long, but it was pretty long for me. And it wasn't going to last much longer, I can tell you that. I look back, I got out of college and ended up in the Marine Corps, and some people have had careers in the Marine Corps, and the best I could do is tell you that it was my hobby. Because drinking was my full-time occupation. I was so busy thinking about drinking, making up stories about drinking, recovering from drinking, getting out of jail, trying to write down the lies, keeping it straight, getting the shape, having the illness progress and trying to explain it to yourself. I mean, it's real. When you think about how good we get at rationalization, so that we're standing there in the winter time sweating. Do you know if a regular person was standing outside and it was 30 below and they were in a t-shirt and they were just going, God, I'm just sweating all over the place. They would probably go to the doctor. I mean, they would just go. But we know, or I knew somehow, that it had something to do with drinking. And if I acknowledged that there was a problem here, it would automatically target in on, hey, let's not drink. And that type of thinking was out of the question. There was no way we were going to get into a conversation that got down that road of, hey, Sandy, why don't you stop drinking? That was so life-threatening that it never even got started. And so I would be out there, where, you know, 30 below in the t-shirt sweating, and I'd go, good way to lose weight. You know what I mean? Hey, good way to stay thin. I've really come up with something clever here. But no way was it a problem. I never could we even take one step down that road of thinking that we're going to do something about our drinking. It was such a core essence of my life that I didn't even entertain any thoughts about doing anything about drinking. Therefore, I had to explain all of my bizarre behavior in other terms. And you know, that's what we are so sensational at. I just think we're absolutely amazing how we explain bizarre behavior in socially acceptable explanations. And the people around us who buy it are sicker than we are. Just amazing, you know, our employers and people around us, and they go, let me get that straight. A dirigible flew over your house last night. Yeah. You had to climb up the ladder. Yes, I did. You know, and they go, God, I don't know. I mean, what are you going to do? Call the guy on this? There he is. And all of that tremendous denial and lying and rationalization was just eventually came intuitively, so that we just think through how to do these things. And I remember at lunch about 15 years ago, we were joking around the table about how non-alcoholics don't get to experience what the essence of the disease of alcoholism is, and they're missing something. They're missing something rather spectacular, because alcoholics get to solve problems that most people will never be part of. You know what I'm talking about? I mean, take just in my own story, learning how to air-to-air gunnery. And this involves, you know, high-speed formation flying, four planes, and the tow plane is pulling a target through the air, and you're coming in, and you have about a quarter of a second to fire when you get in. I think we fired between 1,200 feet and 800 feet, and you just... Oh, it took all this coordination and everything, and you flew in, and your bullets were painted different colors, and you got down, they counted all the hits, and who got the most hits was the winner, so there was instant acknowledgement of whether you failed or succeeded, and so there was all of these pressures and variables that are involved in that. That's for a regular pilot. Now, the alcoholic is doing all of that and throwing up in his oxygen mask. You know, and so we always have a whole dimension of dilemmas that we're doing. We're trying to make a sales presentation and convince people to buy our product and not faint. You know what I mean? Hey, I'm losing consciousness. All right, folks, hiding handcuffs or wristbands from nut wards, you know. Well, I'd like you to go ahead and, you know, you just have a whole dimension of going on. And so we were sitting around the table, and we came up with this idea that we ought to have a Parker Brothers game. And if you haven't heard this, I'll share it with you. For the non-alcoholics. And the name of the game is, So You Want to Be an Alcoholic. And it's played like Monopoly, and there's a Monopoly board, and there's little bars and grills and police stations, and you roll the dice, and you go around, and you get to... and you get to take... Let me tell you how it works before you... And we're taking orders after the meeting back over there. And eventually you come to Community Chest, or you take a chance. That's the one. And you pick it up, and now the game becomes for real. And the card says, you will accompany these two gentlemen and do whatever they say, and you will be blindfolded. Suddenly the game takes on a new dimension. You're no longer sitting at the board. You've been blindfolded, led off by these two gentlemen who escort you quickly in a car, board a plane, fly you to a city. You have no idea what city you're in. Whisk you into a hotel, take you up to the fifth floor where you have a lovely suite of rooms, and they run up about a $4,000 bill on the room. They leave you in just your underwear with $4.70 cash. You are then instructed that you must take two thumbtacks and punch them into the palm of your hand and never let on that you hurt. And you have to be in New York City for a job interview in a suit in 12 hours. Go! And those of us that are alcoholic go, man, that's easy because they live. And the reason it's easy is they left the $4.70 so that we can go get a bottle of cheap wine. And inside that bottle of cheap wine is the answer to the problem. Oh, yeah. You remember that? You zoom. Hey, give me that suit. Boom. And we show up there. So we get to try, or at least I recall, every dimension of my life had those things in it. And in the early years of drinking, it was funny. I thought I was a test pilot testing the outer parameters of life. How much can a marriage stand before it collapses? How far can you push a bird kernel and not get court-martialed? Let's see. Somebody has to do this research, and it's lucky that I'm here, you know? You know, what if I puked at mess night? That'll do it, and the generals are all up there, and so we were, you know, out in the outer, and it was funny, and people always had stories. Hey, there's the guy. Then, you know, 5 or 6 years of that, 7 years, whatever it was, then it got old. We didn't want that reputation anymore. And we're trying to move on from that. And then we sort of crossed the line in my drinking where I was trying to hide it. Now I want to be known as the guy who, geez, well, you only had about one drink at the party last night. Yeah, that's right. I'm just trying to just have a drink or two now and then. And I'm drinking, you know, 8 drinks at home before I go to the party and then stay there and try and exercise this tremendous self-restraint and then come home and drink 10 drinks and pass out and go to bed. But my recollection was of the 2 at the party during the 4 hours. It took incredible, torturous existence to create the image that I was more responsible now, that the illness wasn't progressing. So everything was a lie, everything was a denial, and all throughout it was the problem. You're nobody. The only time I was anybody was when I was roaring drunk, just getting ready to pass out. Sometimes on my second drink, I'd be somebody for about a minute. I'd have that feeling, that glow, you know, hey, it's all right, and then into resentment or something like that. And there was that, I would just get glimpses of what life was all about for a fleeting second, and I'd try to chemically adjust it and find that answer. Let's see, what did I do last night? I had some soup. Okay, I'll have soup again tonight. And if I can recreate what I ate yesterday, maybe I could capture that feeling again, you know, of being at peace with the world. But it was getting more and more complicated and more depressing, and I knew I was missing life. See, that was what I think bothered me more than anything, was that I used to have a terrible fear of death. I just kept going, well, pretty soon I may be dying. I may die. And that, you know, since I've been in AA about 10 years ago, I think that sort of went away. And I had a chance to think about it. And you know what the fear really was? It was the fear of never having lived. And then you die. And then, you know, as you're dying, you go, I never lived. And when you haven't lived in the sense that I'm talking about, naturally you're afraid they're going to end it before you figure it out. You know what I mean? And that was what I was so concerned about. And, you know, if I hadn't found AA, I'd still be wandering around out there. I used to, I'm one of these people who says I'm grateful I'm an alcoholic, not just that I'm in AA. And the reason I say that is that I wasn't going anywhere before I started drinking. You know what I mean? Before I started drinking, I was just a 19-year-old nervous, skinny guy walking around wondering what the hell was going on. And if I were to guess what would be, where I'd be if I never had a drink and was standing here tonight, I'd say, I'm an old skinny guy wandering around wondering what the hell's going on. You know what I mean? Because I can't think of anything that would have brought me to the answer. And that's what happened. Eventually, I had a seizure convulsion and ended up in a nut ward and was locked up for 6 months. And in there, a corpsman came in and said, all drunks fall in, right face, and marched me to my first AA meeting. And I sat there in a little blue bathrobe and listened to people talk about God and several other topics that made me extremely nervous. And I went up afterwards and told this one red-headed guy, geez, that's wonderful. I think you got a great program. If I ever run into a guy with a drinking problem, I will send him around to see you. And he gave me a little bit of your basic AA love. And that was the poking in the chest. And he just said, let me just ask you a question, okay? I said, sure, shoot, shoot. Which one of us is going to get in his car and drive on home to his family and which one of us is going to put his little blue bathrobe on and go over in the elevator and go upstairs and get locked up like an animal? And I remember looking at the guy going, I can't believe it. I've only known him a minute. You know, and that's the way AA is, you know. We don't spend a long time getting acquainted before we share the obvious with each other. Have you ever noticed that? If you've ever had a sliver, you've snuck a little glass of wine and your sponsor gets wind of it. He doesn't go, gee, I wonder if that really is that guy. Or if it's something in the carpet, you know what I mean? And well, I don't want to call the shot. We'll just let it slide. Oh, no, no, no. That doesn't happen. I don't know about you all, but my favorite line is, you know, one of us has been drinking. And I'm pretty sure it isn't me. Now, let's examine you. And we get right to the issue at hand. And, you know, that's what happened in AA. I'm very lucky that nut ward, and they got me into that meeting, and I eventually got out of there. And got a sponsor, and he got me to meetings every night for the longest period of time. He was a great big Marine, and his initial introduction in my home was, my name is Bill, this is a 12-step call, I talk, you listen. And he's very big, and I was torn between having a drink or being physically abused by this guy, and I just kept postponing the drink until I could get rid of him. And here it is, all these years later, and he's still my sponsor. And when all else fails, I can think about what'll happen if he finds out that I had a drink. And that works very well, you know what I mean? Because like everybody in sobriety, I have days when the Serenity Prayer upsets me. And tear the damn thing up and throw it away. And on those days, I don't really make any progress, but I'm like the cat on the straw. I just hang in there, you know, and I just go, this too shall pass, whatever the hell it was. And it, in looking back over the problems that I've had in, as a human being, they're just the same as other people have. And they all can be narrowed down into one category. I think about all the problems that there are in the world, and there's really only one. Now, maybe you've got others, but I only have one. And the one problem is, things aren't going my way. That's it. I never have any other problem. You know what I mean? It's like, you don't get promoted, and you don't like that you didn't get promoted. You see, the problem was not getting promoted. You can get not get promoted and say, well, I'll get promoted next year. And then not getting promoted was not a problem. It was a problem when you decided that it was unacceptable that you didn't get promoted. That's when we got a problem. It didn't go my way. And I used to think there were official problems that it was mandatory to get upset about. And you see what I'm saying? In other words, if you didn't get upset, somebody would call a penalty on you. 15-yard penalty, you forgot to get upset for a situation where all human beings must get upset. And I come in here and you told me there's a way of life that will enable us to go through the various situations that are going to hit all of us as we move through life. And we're going to be given a power to take us through this. And if we're working this program a day at a time, it is feasible to remain undisturbed no matter what happens. That's the target. That's what's available. And we see it in each other. I see people with terrible physical problems who are somehow able to rise above it and walk around smiling and helping other people. And I remember when I first saw that, I go, hasn't anybody told them how screwed up they are? What the hell's wrong with them? Don't they see what's going on? I mean, I couldn't understand how they could be missing the obvious. And what I didn't have prior to AA was a higher power. I didn't realize that the way to be lifted above these problems is not by myself and not by my bootstraps, which was my old plan, but through what you've taught me here in Alcoholics Anonymous, by learning about a higher power. And the first thing I had to do with that, like so many of us, was to change my mind about a higher power. You know, that's the difference between being an atheist and an ex-atheist. Only takes about 10 seconds. All you do is change your mind. You know what I mean? And that's what the chapter to the agnostic. You know, I remember that chapter in the big book. First time I saw it, I got a big book. You know how you get it, and your sponsor gives you one. I want you to really read this thing so you take it home. And the guy is serious. And you can tell he's going to hurt you if you don't read it. So I remember getting the book home and I opened it up like this. Got the binding all bent and then moved pages around and went like that. Then I got a coffee cup and I put a coffee stain on that page and on that page and that page. Then I got a felt tip and underline. Wow, that's wild over here at Arrow. And I put the damn thing on a shelf and left it there, but I was ready if you ever said, you got a big book, you've been reading, oh, let me show you this book, you know. And in doing that, I remember spotting the chapter of the agnostic, and I remember going, God, I'm glad that's in there. That must be how us agnostics work the program. And the rest of the book is how the rest of those people who get involved in all those steps and higher power and all that stuff work the program. So it was very reassuring to know that there was a chapter for the people who wanted to avoid the rest of the program. Even though I'd never read it, I knew what was in there because, like so many of us, I know stuff without doing it. You know that? You all know that. So if you're new and you've gotten that far in your big book studies, I'll save you the trouble of reading the chapter. How about that? It's a long chapter. I'll tell you what it says. It says, change your mind. That's what it says. It says, become an ex-agnostic. That's what it says in there. And the dilemma is, and I'm going to shut up here in just a few minutes, the dilemma in Alcoholics Anonymous is that whenever I think about this, Bill writes about it in the big book, and it reminds me of Jack Benny. Every time there's so much humor in ourselves as we wrestle with the profound dilemmas of life, like whether we're an alcoholic or not. You remember that? The guy has a PhD. He's wrestling with whether he's an alcoholic or not. He's weighing the evidence over here and the evidence over here. And then he comes to the conclusion he's been one for 10 years. Now think about that. A retroactive decision back for 10 years that he was wrestling with today, right? I said, I'm not sure I am. Okay, I was for 10 years. I don't know about you, but I find that hilarious. And, you know, belongs in a sitcom. And anyway, the Jack Benny story that I think applies to our second step, in the radio show, they say the funniest line that Jack Benny ever got involved a little scenario where all you heard was the sound effect man making the footsteps of Benny walking down a hall, and then a stick-up man stepped out and said, "Your money or your life?" And then the silence started that built into 10 seconds, 15 seconds, and then the studio audience started laughing lightly, and then 30 seconds went by, and the laughter started building as Benny still hadn't said anything. And finally, the stick-up man's patience got so bad, he said, "Well," and Benny said, "I'm still thinking." And we sat there going, how could a man be thinking between the money or his life? And he was a tightwad, and that was his benchmark, and so was this very humorous decision. And there's a line in writing about the second step, which I find equally humorous, that applies to us, when Bill writes, "To live on a spiritual basis or to die an alcoholic death are not easy choices to make." And yet how many of us in this room have wrestled with that? Oh, there's God and steps and inventory and go down that road. So we come back and we talk to a doctor friend of ours and we go, how bad is an alcoholic death? Is there anything you can take to, you know, make it easier? I mean, we're actually wrestling with the alternative, or we're back, we leave AA and run off to someone who says there's a third choice. And we go, good, good, because those two are unacceptable. And we buy a book that says Life Through Carrot Peelings. I'm like, well, maybe. You remember how many alternatives we'll look for? What, what? You have a different answer? And then with none of them work. That's the problem. None of them work. And we finally, beaten, having explored every possible alternative to a living life on a spiritual basis, we come back and go, okay, what's the deal? And then they take us right down this road, and it works just as well for us as it did for everybody else. And then we get up and we try and explain why we didn't do it in the first place. And I look back, and there's no explanation for why we didn't do it in the first place, why we didn't, on our first meeting, run home and take all 12 steps and have a spiritual awakening. We're human beings, and that's what makes our stories. I look at it, and I guess that, in a way, I'm kind of grateful, you know, it makes me appreciate what I've been given. And I started out talking about the lesson that I got from... And I'll tell you what it is. It's a very simple thing, that what is it to be somebody? And I think he just put it in the simplest terms I've ever put it. In other words, what is the goal? What could you possibly be in order to be somebody? A child of God. There it is. You can't go beyond that. There isn't anything above that. There isn't any other target to aim at. You know, I'd like to be a child of God and a president of the United States. I mean, that's it. Once you're there, once you're in that secure position, once that's all you're trying to get, it'll be given to us. It's getting rid of wanting all the other things that has been my struggle as I slowly abandon the limited objectives that I had set for myself and try a day at a time with sponsors prodding and guys like Clancy around, foul over here, you know, to get us back on course. We get there. And I think that's how we do it, is as a group. We can see when the other guy is getting off course a little bit, and I can see when he's getting. And if we help each other, we just walk right down that road, and we all get the same destination. And I'll tell you, I am so glad to be part of it. And if you're new, you just stay with this crowd. You are going to become somebody in spite of yourself. Thanks a lot.